tonight, we move on to consider some of the points that show itself rather than just the importance of studying it, how he actually characterizes the book in his review of the first Baha'i century, God Passes By. We've discussed in previous sessions the great advantage we have in being able to look at the revelation through Shoghi Effendi's appraisal of it, through his interpreter's eye. It's as if Baha'u'llah has opened above us a vast firmament of limitless stars and endless worlds and galaxies. And when we look at it, we're just kind of overwhelmed. We don't know how to make sense out of any of it. But Shoghi Effendi superimposes on it the signs of the zodiac, if you will. He shows us the relationship between things. He says, this is a major constellation here, and this is this, and this stands for this, and this means that. So that when we look, now we begin to see patterns, we begin to see relationships, we begin to see a balance between the various events of the first 5 centuries, and beyond that we begin to see a certain hierarchical arrangement of the writings and works of Baha'u'llah. Central to everything, of course, is the Kitab-i-Aqdas, the most holy book, which is a book of laws and teachings of the faith. And then the Iqan, which, as we pointed out last week, and as you have seen yourselves, I'm sure, in the writings, is the preeminent doctrinal work of Baha'u'llah. This is one of three, what Shoghi Effendi characterizes as three immortal fruits of the Baghdad period, along with the hidden words and the seven valleys. The Iqan, the hidden words, and the seven valleys. Three immortal fruits of the Baghdad period, and they're among his first works. Fortunately for us, Shoghi Effendi has reviewed the contents of Baha'u'llah's major writings in God Passes By. And it's a very convenient way to come to understand the various subject matter that has been introduced by Baha'u'llah into each of these works. And for that matter, he deals with other works such as The Will and Testament of Abdul Baha, where you can find a summary. So all of this is very helpful for the student to know what to look at when he's looking at the larger work. Now, in the process of analyzing, summarizing the Kitab-i-Iqan, Shoghi Effendi has made a list in the Iqan, God Passes By, of 15 themes. And those themes then become, in a sense, a key to the book. In other words, one way you can, of course, enter the book and read it, move through it, let it move you as it will as you move along. Another way that you can then do it is take the list of these major themes, and as you're reading, keep reviewing the list and seeing where these themes are found, so that you build, in a sense, an index to the book itself relating to this list of subjects and important themes of the book. In that way, you're doing double work. You're reading, but you're studying at the same time. You remain alert, and it helps, I find, at least it's helped in my study, to center and focus on what you're reading about, rather than just being kind of carried along by the thing. This relates to the question of symbology of certain religious terms of the past. Let's see, that's item 7 or 8 on the list. And marking down the page numbers, marking down the individual points or terms that Baha'u'llah is interpreting and explaining, such as life, such as death, such as resurrection, such as return, all these various themes that are woven through the holy books of the past. So if you're reading, you can find this in God Passes By on page 138, 139. You'll find the summary that we're going to read tonight and discuss some ancillary points related to its content. This is really the ideal introduction to the Iqan, as set forth by Shoghi Effendi. He places the book in relation to others. He places it in its historical context. He sets forth the circumstance of its revelation. And he also indicates its fundamental and underlying purpose. To read from the text itself, it says, "Foremost among the priceless treasures cast forth from the billowing ocean of Baha'u'llah's revelation ranks the Kitab-e-Ghan, the Book of Surtur, revealed within the space of 2 days and 2 nights in the closing years of that period." This is 1862 or 1278 after the Hijra. "It was written in fulfillment of the prophecy of the Bab." Did you know that? "Who had specifically stated that the Promised One would complete the text of the unfinished Persian Bayan. And in reply to the questions addressed to Baha'u'llah by the as yet unconverted maternal uncle of the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, while on a visit with his brother Haji Mirza Hasan Ali to Karbala. A model of Persian prose of a style at once original, chaste and vigorous, and remarkably lucid, both cogent in argument and matchless in its irresistible eloquence. This book, setting forth in outline the grand redemptive scheme of God, occupies a position unequaled by any work in the entire range of Baha'i literature, except the Kitab-e-Aqdas, Baha'u'llah's most holy book. Revealed on the eve of the declaration of his mission, it proffered to mankind the choice sealed wine, whose seal is of must, and broke the seals of the book referred to by Daniel, and disclosed the meaning of the word destined to remain closed up till the end, till the time of the end." This is the opening paragraph of the summary. The second paragraph has to do with the content itself. We'll come back to that, but I'd like to make some comments about the material that I just read. With regard to the time of revelation, the space of 2 days, within the space of 2 days and 2 nights. Now, I've heard some of the people who've been teaching about it say that Baha'u'llah was revealing the whole period for 2 days and 2 nights. And he just stopped for tea and then he would go on, you know. But I don't think it was that. It was within the space of 2 days and 2 nights. And as one can read it out loud in less than 48 hours, I suppose that it could be revealed in less than that amount of time. There's no indication that he did it non-stop, in other words. It's just that it came very rapidly. There were times when Baha'u'llah would reveal verses with such rapidity that no one could take them down at all. And even Manuensis has testified that at times he could only get 1 out of 5 verses when he was writing with this revelatory writing very quickly, taking notes, depending on Baha'u'llah to afterwards help him to fill in whatever was missing. But at the moment of revelation, this is not a time of composition as we would understand when we go to write something, but an impetuous and moving, shaking experience for the manifestation of God from the few indications that we have, where his whole being is taken up with this contact with the power that's flowing through him. And there are a number of references in the writings themselves to the rapidity with which both the Bab and Baha'u'llah reveal divine verses. One of them has been set forth in the writings in the following manner. "A certain Muhammad Karim, a native of Shiraz, who had been a witness to the rapidity and the manner in which the Bab had penned the verses with which he was inspired, has left the following testimony to posterity. After attaining during those days the presence of Baha'u'llah, and beholding with his own eyes what he himself had considered to be the only proof of the mission of the Promised One, I bear witness that the verses revealed by Baha'u'llah were superior in the rapidity with which they were penned, in the ease with which they flowed, in their lucidity, their profundity, and sweetness to those which I myself sought for from the pen of the Bab when in his presence. Had Baha'u'llah no other claim to greatness, this was sufficient in the eyes of the world and its people, that he produced such verses as have streamed this day from his pen. Now, the envious position of this certain Muhammad Karim, who was in the presence of both the Bab and Baha'u'llah when they were revealing divine verses, he needs no commentary, imagine such an experience, having two manifestations close to each other and having had that unique possibility. As to the date 1862, which is indicated here by the Guardian, there are several passages in the Quran itself which indicate the date of its revelation. For instance, on page 226, there's a reference to these holy lights have for 18 years heroically endured the showers of affliction. So if you take the 18 from 1844 and add 18 to it, what does that bring you to? In the lunar calendar, the Agon was revealed in the year 1278, and the faith was founded in 1260. So if you count that, that's 18 years earlier. That it was founded, basically. And that was the date, obviously, the date for the lunar date for the revelation of the Agon. He also refers here to the closing years of that period, 1862 being very approximate to 1863, when Baha'u'llah declared his mission and moved on from Baghdad to go to Constantinople. So it's at the close of this period. That period refers to the Baghdad period, particularly the 6 years following the return of Baha'u'llah from his two-year retirement in Kurdistan, which took place. 6 years being 1856 to 1863. Agon was revealed during the time Baha'u'llah resided in an extremely modest residence, which he later designated as the most great house, his most holy habitation, out of which had gone forth, as he said, the breath of the All-Glorious, and from which had poured forth in ceaseless strains the melody of the All-Merciful. It's this house which Baha'u'llah has ordained in the Kitab-i Aqdas as the center of pilgrimage, one of the two centers of pilgrimage with the House of the Bab in Shiraz. Now, with the destruction of the House of the Bab in Shiraz, this is the only house at the moment, although I'm sure we will rebuild the House of the Bab in the future. We have all the plans, we have parts of the house that have been retired even at that time, certain elements of it. And no doubt the time will come. We have Shiraz without the House of the Bab right now. In the future, we may have the House of the Bab without Shiraz. We will see what happens. Because there will be open spaces around the house. There will be other things that will happen. As to the prophecy of the Bab that's mentioned here, the Bab is specified that the Bayan is not completed and that he whom God would manifest, in other words, Baha'u'llah would complete it, though not in its actual form, but only spiritually in the form of another book. The Quran is believed to be its continuation. And this is a letter published in Dawn of a New Day on page 78, but I just read you from the Guardian, written on his behalf. Then Shoghi Effendi, in another part of God Passes By, refers to the Bayan itself. And he tells us the following. He says, this is peerless among the doctrinal works of the founder of the Babi dispensation. Now, we know this is preeminent among Baha'u'llah's doctrinal works, the Agon. Now, we see that the Bayan was preeminent among the doctrinal works of the Bab. Although it was a book of laws, Shoghi Effendi characterizes it as a book of doctrine as well. It has laws, but that was not its main purpose. Its main purpose was doctrine. It consists of 9 vahid. Each Vahed of 19 chapters, except the last Vahed comprising only 10 chapters. This book of about 8,000 verses, occupying a pivotal position in Babi literature, should be regarded primarily as a eulogy of the Promised One, rather than a code of laws and ordinances designed to be a permanent guide to future generations. The Bab himself comments on the position of the Bayan in relation to the revelation of the Promised One. Thus, I swear by the most holy essence of God, exalted and glorified be He, that in the day of the appearance of Him whom God shall make manifest, 1,000 perusals of the Bayan cannot equal the perusal of a single verse to be revealed by Him whom God shall make manifest. And know thou of a certainty that every letter revealed in the Bayan is solely intended to evoke submission unto Him whom God shall make manifest. For it is He who hath revealed the Bayan prior to His own manifestation. I've been searching for the first of these two verses yesterday and today for the Akhtas project, and I'm glad that in this class it's now come out again. Very helpful. Baha'u'llah makes reference to the how the Bab extols above his own writings a single verse of Him whom God shall make manifest. I'm trying to find the counterpart, and this is the verse that seems to correspond to it. Now you noted as we were reading there, 9 Vaheds, 19 chapters each, the last one only 10 chapters. So there were these additional 9 chapters that would be given by Baha'u'llah as his indication of the Bab. As to the question of the choice sealed wine, whose seal is of musk, this is a reference to an earlier holy book. Particular one choice of sealed wine you can trace back to the Quran, Surah 83, verses 25 and 26. Where it refers to the choice sealed wine that it will be given them to quaff, the seal of musk. You know what musk is? Musk is just it comes from an animal like a deer, and it has a certain pouch on its back, and there's waxy substance there, and a very fragrant substance that's used in preparation of perfumes and things like that. According to various Muslim commentators, this verse refers to the wine which is drunk by the righteous in paradise, the choice sealed wine. Its vessels are said to be sealed with musk instead of clay. Commonly the wine is sealed with clay. This special choice sealed wine was sealed with musk. A number of passages from Baha'u'llah's tablets refer to this choice sealed wine. For example, verily I say the seal of the choice wine hath in the name of Him who is the self-subsisting been broken. Withhold not thyself therefrom. And in the opening of the Kitab-i Aqdas he says, think not that we have revealed unto you a mere code of laws, nay rather we have unsealed the choice wine with the fingers of might and power. And again in the epistle he says, by the righteousness of God, idle fancies have debarred men from the horizon of certitude. Come to this matter of certitude again. And vain imaginings withheld them from the choice sealed wine. Baha'u'llah identifies his revelation as the outpouring of the choice sealed wine, so that in the same way we have the kingdom of God on earth, now we have availability of that spiritual refreshment that comes through the verses of God while we're still resident, if you will, in this life. The significance attributed to this spiritual wine, in contrast to the wine that men drink, has been unfolded by Baha'u'llah in the following words. Hear ye God, O people of the earth, and think not that the wine we have mentioned in our tablets is the wine which men drink, and which causeth their intelligence to pass away, their human nature to be perverted, their light to be changed, and their purity to be soiled. Our intention is indeed that wine which intensifieth man's love for God, for his chosen ones, and for his loved ones, and igniteth in the heart the fire of God, and love for Him, and glorification and praise of Him. So potent is this wine that a drop thereof will attract him who drinketh it to the court of his sanctity and nearness, and will enable him to attain the presence of God, the King, the Glorious, the Most Beauteous. It is a wine that blotteth out from the hearts of the true lovers all suggestions of limitation, establishes the truth of the signs of his oneness and divine unity, and leadeth them to the tabernacle of the well-beloved, in the presence of God, the sovereign Lord, with self-subsisting, the all-forgiving, the all-generous. We meant by this wine the river of God in his favor, the fountain of his living water, and the mystic wine in its divine grace, even as it was revealed in the Quran, if ye are of those who understand. He said, and how true is his utterance, a wine delectable to those who drink it. And he had no purpose in this but the wine we have mentioned to you, O people of certitude. And broke the seals of the book. This is a reference, a biblical reference, to the book of Daniel, chapter 12, verse 4, which states, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end, and disclose the meaning of the words destined to remain closed up till the time of the end." This is citing from God Passes By. This is also in Daniel 12, verse 9. "And he said, Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end." And you could also note down to read in relation to this chapter 10 of Semantic Questions, which deals with traditional proofs exemplified from the book of Daniel, which goes more into the meaning of these matters. The manuscript, it mentions here, 200 pages. This is the length of the original Persian manuscript copy in Abdu'l-Bahá's calligraphy. As to the maternal uncle of the Bab, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, he was one of three brothers of Fatima Begum, the mother of the Bab. I'll go into more details about these uncles in a bit. It's interesting to note that because of its recipient, the Igan was originally known as the Resale-i Khal, or the treatise to the uncle. Baha'u'llah himself, as we mentioned last week, has renamed it in a tablet that it should be known in the future as the Kitab-i Igan, Book of 32. Now, have some background on how the uncle of the Bab came to ask the questions that he did of Baha'u'llah. To give us a little background about the uncle and his own experiences with the Bab in the Bab's lifetime, because you realize, of course, this is in 1862, this is what, 12 years after the martyrdom of the Bab, that he's getting around to asking these questions. He seems to have, as were his brothers, to have been deeply impressed with the Bab in his own lifetime, in the lifetime of the Bab. In the spring of 1845, the Bab was returning to Bushir from his pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina. If you recall, after his declaration, he left out on pilgrimage and went there. Then he returned to Bushir. And the news had reached him that he proclaimed his cause to some of his fellow pilgrims and to some of the Muslim dignitaries. And his host in Bushir was this same Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the oldest of his maternal uncles. Though unaware of the glorious station of his illustrious nephew at that time, he wrote to his mother and his sister thus: "To my radiant and honored mother and sister, may the peace of God be upon you. I am honored to present to your sanctified being to present to your sanctified being that we have been blessed praised by God for His Eminence Janabi Haji has safely arrived. And this is a very literal translation. And I am pleased to spend my time in His presence. He's come back, he says, announces to the mother and the sister that in Bushehr, which is the coastal town away from Shiraz, that he has the honor of being in the presence of Janabi Haji, which is a reference to his holiness, the pilgrim, the one who has made the pilgrimage, a reference, in other words, to his nephew, the Bab. It seems advisable that he should stay in Bushehr for a short while, but please rest assured that soon he will depart for his home in Shiraz. Truly his bountiful soul is the source of felicity for the people of this world and the next. He brings honor to us all. So he was understanding something at that stage, it seems quite clear. The news of the claim of the Bab had reached Shiraz, and it caused the mother of the Bab and the family grave concern and worry, and the uncle of the Bab, bearing this in mind, continues his letter, and he says the following: "Praise be God, and again praise be God for His favor. God willing, the Bab's cause is undeniable. Do not be dismayed by the sayings of the people, and allow no trace of doubt in your heart. Be not perturbed by the tales you may hear, as the Lord of the world is His protector and defender." The mother of the children, in other words, the uncle's wife, sends her greetings and says to my dear sister that, alas, I am not there to tell Aga Mirza Abu Khazim's mother that, praise God, for you have no reason to be ashamed. You have a son-in-law which has no equal in the world. The whole world should abide by his will. And again, a short while later, another letter, this time to his younger brother, another uncle of the Bab, and where he testifies further about the truth of the mission of the Bab. He was still at this time acting as a host of his nephew. He explains the sadness of the Bab upon hearing of the doubts that were created in the minds of some of his relatives about the authenticity of his claim. You know, we've read in other times about the gentleness and meekness of the Bab, and this kind of awareness that comes upon him that here he's giving this precious gift to the world, and there's people denying it and turning away from it, and even his own relatives are going to raise problems. His Honor the Bab, in many of his writings, has testified that whosoever is in doubt about his cause and prides himself in following the path of truth should come forth and face him. How can a person so assured of his claims, God forbid, be in vain? If they say that he is insane, any reason would refute that. For how is it that when he was sane, he was unlettered, and soon after he became insane, he appears as the greatest of the learned ones? For this servant, in other words, the uncle, there remains no doubt and no reason exists for diffidence. As I can see and understand, this cause is from God. Now, the question of the promised Qayyim, the matter of being the promised Qayyim, has, I don't believe at this stage, come out clearly in this situation, because it's around those, the matter of the Bab being the fulfillment of all the prophecies of the promised Qayyim, that the questions that the uncle of the Bab addresses to Baha'u'llah. This seems to be another stage in his acceptance. But that he seems to identify the Bab as bringing inspiration from God and a blessing to the family. This seems clear from these extracts from his letters. Whether that or whether he had some belief in the Bab from the beginning but kept it secret, we don't know. There's an extract here from Mr. Tarzadi's volume 1 of the Revelation of Baha'u'llah. It says the following: "During the initial stages of our discussion, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad maintained a negative attitude and would repudiate any truth or argument that I put forward. These discussions lasted for several meetings. Once, when I was talking with great fervor and conviction about the faith, he turned to me in astonishment and exclaimed, 'Are you really saying that my nephew is the promised Qayyim? When I reaffirmed my belief that he was, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad became perplexed and expressed his view that this was all very strange. He then began to meditate and was lost in thought. Seeing him in this reflective mood, I could not prevent myself from laughing. He asked my reason for laughing, but as it would reflect badly upon him, I was reluctant to tell him. This is an account by Haji Sayyid Shahrari Karbalai. However, he insisted on wanting to know what was the cause of his humor, and he said that I told him, your view that your nephew cannot be the promised Qayyim is similar to the objection which Abu Lahab had. Now, this was an uncle of Muhammad who wanted to know how could his nephew be the messenger of God. And this similarity struck the high teacher at that moment, and so he was laughing. He also said, how could it be possible for my nephew to become a prophet? But he said, Muhammad was the true prophet of God. Now it's up to you to investigate this cause. You must be very proud that this son of truth dawned from your family and its light shone forth from your home. Do not hold back from it and be not surprised. For God is able to make of your nephew the promised one of Islam. Be assured that the hands of God are never tied. It seems that Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad was moved by these words, and he said, this is an irrefutable answer. Now what shall I do? I suggested to him that he might go as a pilgrim to the holy shrines in Iraq, where he could also visit his sister. Now, that was the mother of the Bab, by that time, you know, had moved to Karbala, who had been living there since the martyrdom of her son, and then go to Baghdad, attain the presence of Baha'u'llah, ask his questions of him, and put forward his difficulties. I urged him to persevere in his search and to rely upon God. I expressed the hope that the veils which now prevented him from seeing the truth might be lifted from his eyes and that he might attain to the true faith of God. He agreed to my suggestion and said that he felt in his heart that this was the right course to take. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad thereupon wrote a letter to his youngest brother, Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, who was a merchant in Yazd, acquainted him with his plans to visit the shrines and their sister, and invited him to join him in the journey. Haji Mirza Hassan Ali accepted and asked his brother to wait until he joined him in Shiraz. They both traveled to Iraq via Bushir. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, however, did not intimate the real purpose of his journey to his brother until they had arrived in Baghdad. Then he informed him that his primary object in traveling to Iraq was to investigate the authenticity of the faith and then to visit the shrines and the mother of the Bab. He invited his brother to remain in Baghdad for a short period so that they could attain the presence of Baha'u'llah and afterwards proceed to visit the shrine. On hearing this, Haji Mirza Hassan Ali became angry, and although his junior in age, he spoke harshly to his brother. He warned that under no circumstance would he become a partner in these matters, and that he did not wish to hear about the faith. And on that very day, he left Baghdad. So he went back and was not involved in these interviews with Baha'u'llah, although through the grace of God later, he was also blessed and attained to acceptance of Baha'u'llah and of the Bab. After visiting the shrine, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad came back to Baghdad, and there, through the efforts again of Haji Sayyid Javari Karbalai, attained the presence of the Blessed Beauty. His youngest brother did not accompany him. In one of his tablets, written on behalf of his secretary, Mirza Aga Jan, so it's not in the first person, but in like something written on behalf of Baha'u'llah, the following has been noted down. One day, Haji Sayyid Javari Karbalai came to the presence of Baha'u'llah, informing him that Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, the uncle of the Bab, in company of the other brother, Haji Sayyid Hassan Ali, have come to visit Najaf and Karbala, and are on their way back to Iran. The Blessed Beauty asked Javari Karbalai whether he had taught them the faith. Upon receiving the negative response, Baha'u'llah said that you should always be engaged in teaching the faith. Return, he said, give our greetings to them and bring them to us. He left and the next day returned with the revered uncle who attained the presence of Baha'u'llah. However, only the older uncle came without the other brother. The ocean of utterance of the desire of the world, in other words, Baha'u'llah, surged with such magnitude that no one was able to bear its greatness. At last, he said, we do not wish that you be deprived of the fruits of wisdom and utterance that have grown out of the holy tree which flourishes from your midst. The uncle replied, my master, for 1,200 years we heard the promised Kayim, that the promised Kayim is residing in the same cities, these allegorical cities of Jabulka and Jabulsa that are mentioned in Islamic literature. They're supposed to be underground cities. The 12th Imam is supposed to have disappeared to them. He will come out in the time of the end from those cities and triumph over the world. And his children are each living in grandeur and greatness in those cities. Aside from this, what has happened to the stories of the holy cities? Where did the mention of the sea and the carpet go? And there's other references to Islamic tradition. Now they say that he is your nephew. How can this servant accept it? Whatsoever I heard from the past, the opposite of these things are as evident as the daylight sun. The tongue of grandeur Baha'u'llah uttered this exalted word. O uncle, return to thy abode, think about the sayings and the chronicles you mentioned, and whatsoever is the cause of thy hesitation, specify them, and then return with thy brother. God willing, thy doubts will be reversed through the words of certitude, as God is powerful over all things. The next day, without his brother, the uncle came and presented one by one his doubts and received the answers. The answers became known among the people as the epistle of the uncle. However, through divine wisdom, eventually the name was changed by Baha'u'llah to the Kitab-i-Zayn. The questions posed by the uncle to Baha'u'llah are preserved. They're written in two pages in his own hand and have four headings. Now, at least you can see, that is a photocopy of the letter of the uncle of the Ba'ath with these various questions. So we have actually the exact text of it in his hand. We'll come back to the content of the questions in the general categories in a moment. But first, let's go on with the story. The revelation of the Agan dispelled all the doubts of the heart of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, and he became a devoted believer to the end of his life. He's left for posterity his impression from meeting Baha'u'llah in Baghdad in a letter to his son, Haji Mirza Muhammad Taqi, who also became a believer, in which he wrote, I attained the presence of His Honor Baha, may peace be upon him, and I wish you could have been present. He treated me with the utmost affection and favor and graciously asked me to stay for the night. It is an absolute truth that deprivation from His bounteous presence is a grievous loss. May God bestow upon me the privilege of attaining His presence perpetually. Later in his will and testament, he wrote the following. It says, in the name of God the Most Glorious, firstly I bear witness to the oneness of God, to His holy essence, which is beyond and greater than any comprehension of man. Moreover, I bear witness that the holy and exalted being that appeared in the year 1260 to him, and that proclaimed his station is from God, testifies in his will to the reality of the Ba'ath's mission. He is the dawning place of the greatness and omnipotence of God. Great is his station. Whatsoever he has uttered regarding religion and the recognition of God are all the truth. Whosoever obeyed him will be numbered among the ones saved, and whosoever opposed him will perish. The religion of God for today is what His Holiness the Bab has brought. And today the Lord of religion and the propagator of these radiant people is His Holiness the Glorious Baha. May my soul and the souls of all the people of the world be a sacrifice unto him. Baha'u'llah's blessed appearance is the same as the appearance of the one before him, of the Ba'ath. Obedience to him is obedience to God, and opposition towards him is opposition towards God. This is the belief of this servant who is drowned in the sea of sinfulness, who due to the weakness of his own self has kept his belief a secret from all the people, even from his own children and family. I testify to it in these pages, so that after my passing they may know and begin considering their own condition and pursue, investigate, and understand the matter of the religion of the Bab, in Baha'u'llah, in other words. If God willing, they will become believers. I entreat the readers of this passage, be it my own relatives and children or strangers, that after my passing, that they should, he goes on to say, they should follow the instructions of the Bayan for his burial, and he wishes to be buried in Shiraz, and other details about his life. He passed away in 1877, and he was buried according to his wish near the Shah Chiragh in a mosque, the famous mosque in Shiraz. His wife and five children all became Baha'is and remained faithful till the end of their lives. The original copy of the Igan, as we said, is in the handwriting of Abdu'l-Bahá, who was 18 years of age at the time that he penned it. In the margin of some of the pages, Baha'u'llah, in his own hand, has written some comments, corrections, and additions. And toward the end of the book, he wrote in the margin a phrase which has Shoghi Effendi has taken as one of the frontest quotations for the Dawnbreakers. Amidst them all, we stand life in hand, wholly resigned to his will. But perchance through God's loving kindness and his grace, this revealed and manifest letter may lay down his life as a sacrifice in the path of the primal point. Now, we go back to our other account here. It may be helpful to read a quotation from one of the books on Shia Islam. This is an introduction to this question of the Qayyim. And this is important because I think in reading the Igan, if you haven't had some of the background of Islam, you'll find that it seems to be referring a lot to Islam. Why does Baha'u'llah refer more to quotations from the Quran and from the Bible? Doesn't refer to other religions. We have to remember that in the first instance here, he's addressing a Muslim. The book is addressed to a Muslim. So he's drawing on proofs from the Quran and from the Muslim experience that this man has had. Shia Islam has been commented on in a number of books and articles that written by Baha'is now, which give us a fairly clear picture of what it's all about. The knowledge of faith or basic understanding of Islam, which is important to all of us so that we can understand the origins of the revelation of the Bab and indeed of Baha'u'llah. It helps open the way to any Western reader, really, to more fully appreciate the references that are found throughout the Igan to this topic. It's useful to remember that the recipient of the Igan not only was a Muslim, but was a Shia Muslim. Phil Hatcher and Douglas Martin have provided a brief introduction to Shia Islam in their book on the faith. They've written on the faith, the Baha'i Faith, the Emerging Global Religion. Like Christianity before it, Islam gradually divided into a number of major sects. One of the most significant of these is the Shia sect, which believes that it was Muhammad's intention that his descendants inherit the spiritual and temporal leadership of the faithful. These chosen ones, called imams or leaders, were believed to be endowed with unqualified infallibility in the discharge of their related responsibilities. However, the great majority of Muslims rejected such claims, believing that the sunnah, the way or mode of conduct attributed by tradition to the Prophet Muhammad, was sufficient guide. Those who ascribed to this latter belief became known as Sunni. Although Sunni Muslims vastly outnumber the Shia today, and are usually referred to by Western scholars as orthodox as opposed to the heterodoxy of the Shia, Shia Islam has a long and respected tradition, a tradition that only recently has become the object of serious study among a growing group of non-Muslim scholars. And it's the truth that when I started looking into Islamic topics, you couldn't find anything in English on Shia. It was very, very elementary, some reference to it as being one of the sects. But as far as learning about the lives of the 12 imams, it's only now, about 10, 12 years ago, that the first book of Islamic lore about all of the lives of the 12 imams was published, the Kitab al-Irshad, so a very helpful biographical account of the lives of the Shia imams. And since they're cited, and even in the Igan, we find quotes from several of the imams, cited and interpreted or used in the form of proofs by Baha'u'llah, it's very helpful for us to have some idea of the history of these early successors, 12 successors of Muhammad, the first of which was his cousin Ali, Imam Ali. By AD 661, only 29 years after Muhammad's death, power in the Muslim world fell into the hands of the first of a series of dynastic rulers, theoretically elected by the faithful, but in fact representing the dominance of various powerful families. The first of these Sunni dynasties, the Umayyads and the Abbasids, saw the Imams as a challenge to their own legitimacy. Consequently, according to Shia accounts, one Imam after another was put to death, beginning with Hassan and Hussein, the grandsons of Muhammad. That was the second and third Imam. Ali had already been killed by that time. These Imams, or descendants of the Prophet, came in time to be regarded by Shia Islam as saints and martyrs. He was said to have communicated with his followers through a series of deputies. These intermediaries took the title Bab, or gate, because they were the only way to the hidden Imam. There had been four Babs up to the year 941, when the fourth died without naming a successor. The refusal of either the Imam or the final Bab to name a successor implied that the manor was to be left by the faithful entirely in the hands of God. In time, a messenger or messengers of God would appear, one of whom would be the Imam Mahdi or the Qayyim, and who would again provide a direct channel for the divine will to human affairs. It is out of this tradition that the Baha'i religion and its forerunner, the Babi faith, appeared in the mid-19th century. Now you see, we hear the title of the Bab, we say the Bab, well, it doesn't mean anything to us. But for someone to arise and claim to be the Bab, immediately in the minds of the Shias, he identified himself as one of these successors of the Qayyim, of the four Babs. Now, not only did he say he was the Bab, but his title that he assumed was the Babullah, the gate of God, not the Babul Qayyim, the gate of the Qayyim. And this subtlety gradually began to work on the people. And they realized that his claim was more than to be a intermediary with the hidden 12th Imam, with the Qayyim. But in time, he went the stage further and revealed that he was indeed the promised Qayyim himself. And this he did in the presence of the Waliad, of the successor to the throne of Persia, Nasser al-Din Shah, who was a prince at that time in Tabriz, when he was there and when he was interrogated by the religious officials. So Nasser al-Din Shah heard from the lips of the Bab that he was the promised one of God, and he heard it several times. And he still went on to perpetrate whatever he perpetrated. You can't say that he was ignorant of the power and presence and majesty of the Bab. A few notes about the uncles of the Bab. Again, these are the brothers of Fatima Begum, who is the mother of the Bab, who also became a believer later on through the intervention of Baha'u'llah. The Khale Azam, this is Haji Mirza Sayyid Ali. This is the eldest, not the eldest, this is the greatest of the uncles. And this was the one who housed the Bab in Shiraz and also gave his life in the path of the Bab. He recognized the Bab, in other words, from the beginning. He's been characterized by Shoghi Effendi as noble and serene, and God pass us by. He was one of the leading merchants of Shiraz. In the Dawnbreakers it says, it was this same uncle into whose custody the Bab, after the death of his father, was entrusted, and who, on his nephew's return from his pilgrimage to Hejaz and his arrest by Hossein Khan, who was the governor of Fars, assumed undivided responsibility for him by pledging his word in writing. It was he who surrounded him while under his care with unfailing solicitude, who served him with such devotion, and who acted as an intermediary between him and the host of his followers who flocked to Shiraz to see him. He eventually offered up his life as one of the seven martyrs of Tehran, and the account of his death is in the Dawnbreakers as well. Then the uncle of concern with regard to the Igan, Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, is known. The first one is known as Khale Azam, the greatest uncle. This is Khale Akbar, the greater uncle. He's also referred to in some of the writings as Khale Askar, the lesser of the uncles. He engaged in business with the Bab in Bushir. He was unconverted during the ministry of the Bab, but he later traveled to Iraq, where he was called on. He called on Baha'u'llah and became the honored recipient of the Igan. Then we have Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, who was this younger brother that had accompanied Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad in his pilgrimage. And he was known as the Khale Askari, the younger uncle. He was also a merchant who had been engaged in trade with the Bab during his Bab's lifetime. It was later in his life that through circumstances which are not related here, he embraced the faith while in Yazd. Now, I'd like to read a couple more, we didn't have time here, a couple more accounts. Some of this is repetitive, but it doesn't hurt us. We're trying to get this picture in our mind. This is Mr. Baluzzi's one paragraph account of the same things we've just been reading. You'll hear it in another way, and it helps to settle. I think it helps to settle for us. You'll find this particular material in The King of Glory, page 163-165. The Kitabi Gan, or Book of Certitude, was written in answer to questions presented by Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, a maternal uncle of the Bab, entitled Khale Akbar, the greater uncle. He and his brother, Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, were visiting the holy shrines of Iraq in the year 1862. Both of them, during the 6 short eventful years of the ministry of their nephew, had stood firm and steadfast in his support and defense, but neither of them had given him their allegiance. Baha'u'llah himself relates in a tablet that Haji Sayyid Jawhari Karbalai spoke to him of the presence of these two uncles of the Bab in Iraq. And Baha'u'llah inquired, again he talks about this history of whether he taught them the faith and moves on through that. Let's see. Here it gives the name of already in Shiraz, and this is the account I read earlier, and I think I mistakenly identified there that with Sayyid Javadi Karbalai, and you should take note that that early account of the person that inspired the uncles to go to Iraq to meet Baha'u'llah was Agha Mirza Agha Nuruddin, if you're taking down notes on these names. As a youth, Agha Mirza Agha had been converted to the Babi faith by his aunt, Khadija Begum, the wife of the Bab. So he was a relative of the family. Now when Haji Sayyid Javadi Karbalai, whom he had known well for many years, brought Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad this invitation from Baha'u'llah, he gladly and readily responded. Baha'u'llah mentions in the same tablet that when he asked Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad what it was that stood in his way, the latter replied that there were some questions that had caused him great concern. And he explains how Baha'u'llah advised him to write these down. He did. And we can read these questions in the handwriting of Haji Sayyid Muhammad himself today. They're related to the Shia expectations of the advent of the Qa'im of the House of Muhammad. Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad worded his questions under four headings, namely, these are the categories of the questions which prompted the answers in the Agan. The day of resurrection. Is there to be corporeal resurrection? The world is replete with injustice. How are the just to be requited and the unjust punished? The second category, the 12th Imam was born at a certain time and lives on. There are traditions all supporting this belief. How can this be explained? The third, interpretation of the holy text. This cause does not seem to conform with beliefs held throughout the years. One cannot ignore the literal meaning of the holy text and scriptures. How can this be explained? And the fourth, certain events, according to the traditions that have come down from the Imams, must occur at the advent of the Qa'im. Some of these are mentioned, but none of these has happened. How can this be explained? This is the gist of the questions presented to Baha'u'llah by the uncle of the Bab. Now the quotation about having attained the presence of His Honor Baha that he recited, you can find in the Revelation of Baha'u'llah, Volume 1 of Mr. Tarzadeh's books on pages 158 to 159. Now we come to the matter of the manuscript of the Igan. There are some extracts from different sources here about the fate of the manuscript that was the one written in the hand of Abdu'l-Baha, which was given to Haji Mirza Muhammad himself. The first is from Mr. Tarzadeh's Volume 1 of the Revelation of Baha'u'llah. He says that the original copy of the Igan was transcribed by Abdu'l-Baha, who was then 18 years of age. In the margins of the few of his book, he pens some of these passages, one of which I've already read to you. Says, for many years, this original copy of the Kitab-i-Igan remained with the family of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad until in 1948, his great-granddaughter, Fatima Khanumi Afnan, presented it to Shoghi Effendi, the guardian of the faith. It reached him a few years later and has been placed in the Baha'i International Archives building on Mount Carmel in Haifa. It's presently in the vault at the seat of the House of Justice. Mr. Baluzi similarly relates, he says, Baha'u'llah revealed the Igan, answering the questions posed by the uncle of the Bab. And then he goes on to say, Fatima Khanum Afnan, a great-granddaughter of Haji Mirza Sayyid Muhammad, had inherited this manuscript, and she's presented to the guardian of the Baha'i faith. A copy which must have been transcribed for Haji Mirza Hassan Ali, the junior uncle of the Bab, bears a date only 1 year after its revelation, and it is now in the possession of one of Haji Mirza Hassan Ali's great-grandsons. The Book of Certitude was perhaps the earliest of the writings of Baha'u'llah to appear in print. A beautifully lithographed copy, which does not bear a date and must have been printed in Bombay, is known to have been in circulation in the early 80s of the last century. So this is the first first edition copy, you would say, of it. We don't have an exact date on it. That's King of Glory, page 165, where you find those few facts. Now, Dr. G. Carey has written a glorious book called Shoghi Effendi Recollections, which I particularly would recommend to you while you're here in the Holy Land to read, because it has so much to do with the building of the shrines and the development of the gardens and Shoghi Effendi's relationship with Dr. G. Carey. Dr. G. Carey was an extraordinary man. I don't know how many of you have met Dr. G. Carey. There must be people here who knew him. He came here after the passing of his wife and spent several weeks as a guest of Ria Kanum's. And many of the friends who were here at that time had a chance to get to know him. He was an extraordinary presence. He was a duke. I mean, he was of the aristocracy of Sicily. And Ruth Pringle, a counselor, told me that he had recommended that she read the book, The Leopard, which is the story of aristocracy in Sicily, and was made into a film starring Burt Lancaster at some stage, and was a very popular film several decades ago, as this was one of his close relatives, and would give him her insight into the kind of upbringing and the situation that he found himself in. He married one of the aristocracy of Sweden, Angelica, his wife. They became devoted believers, both of them. He was serving the guardian intimately, coming back and forth to the Holy Land. He never lived here, but he was coming oftentimes. He was in communication with Shoghi Effendi. He was seeing to the preparation of the marble and all of the stonework that adorns now today the Shrine of the Bab. In the book, on pages 149 and 150, he tells the following story. I should like to mention an episode which further demonstrates the eager interest of Shoghi Effendi in collecting information and facts pertaining to the sacred writings and the history of the cause. One evening, as I entered the dining room, the guardian was already seated at his place at the table, his face shining with an inner jubilation which he could neither control nor conceal. At his side upon the table stood a small bundle, an object wrapped in a colored silk handkerchief, typical of the East and of Iran in particular. As soon as we were all seated and attentive, even before dinner was served, he said that a pilgrim had that day arrived from Tehran, bringing with him one of the most precious documents to be placed in the archives. He untied the handkerchief and, with great reverence, lifted out a manuscript in book form, placing it in a position that everyone could see, added that it contained two original tablets in the handwriting of Abdu'l-Bahá. One was the Igan, and the other was a tablet, the name of which I do not now remember. These manuscripts, Shoghi Effendi stated, were transcribed by Abdu'l-Bahá in his beautiful calligraphy when he was about 18 years old, and bore some additions in the hand of Baha'u'lláh, insertions which he had written on the margins of many pages in reviewing the manuscripts. Shoghi Effendi had never before seen the original of the Igan, and was deeply astonished to discover that the phrase he had chosen from this book and placed on the title page of his translation of Nabil's narrative, The Dawnbreakers, was an after-reflection of Baha'u'llah's written by himself on the margin of one page. The phrase in question is the one starting, "I stand, life in hand, ready for chances," on which we read earlier. The guardian that evening was not only astonished but overjoyed as well, because he was conscious that through a mysterious process he had been inspired to adopt that phrase as an eternal testimonial to Baha'u'llah's yearning to sacrifice his life for the Bab, the primal point. All of us who were seated at the table were awed and profoundly stirred, and I in particular felt that the existence of a spiritual link between the guardian and the invisible world of God was something that no one should ever doubt. The bearer, the pilgrim that brought the Igan to Shoghi Effendi was Zekrullah Khadr, who later became the hand of the cross. Mr. Khadr. So what has happened to the Gaon in the meanwhile? We had this first edition in the 80s, in Persian, the original language of it. I've got a list here of translations of the Gaon in various languages. I'll just read off the list. It's not in chronological order, it's in alphabetical order, but it'll give you some idea of not only the spread of the Gaon, but the spread of the faith. In Afrikaans, in Albanian, Armenian, Arabic, Bengali, Bulgarian, Burmese, Chinese, Czech, Danish, Dutch, Flemish, English, English Braille. The first English edition was 1904, by the way. Shoghi Effendi's translation of the work came out in 1931. Esperanto, French, German, Gujarati, Japanese, Kurdish, Norwegian, Portuguese, Russian, Serbian, Shona, Spanish, Swedish, Turkish, Urdu, and Xhosa. Within 25 years of its revelation, 28 language editions. I think that finishes this for this evening. We will now take up next week this list of topics and discuss the meaning of them and where they come into the volume. So if you're reading ahead and you have God Passes By, you may wish to look up this list, make your own list out, and start doing this topical analysis of the book. If you've read the book, fine, you can scan through and find things. If you haven't read the book, maybe it'll guide you then to look for these particular sections and passages, see if you can identify them all. Some of them are not easy to trace. It's a good challenge for everybody to try to find them.